Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello everyone, I'm Chris Wynn and welcome to the Rogan Report podcast in association with the Sunderland Community Soup Kitchen, where we are looking back once again to speak to a former player who grew up as a fan of the club and went on to fulfil an ambition that I'm sure most of us have by turning out for the club during his career. And maybe in typical Sunderland fashion, he was only at the club for 2 years, but went through a relegation, a promotion, four managers and two different owners. We are very pleased to be speaking to Tommy Miller. Hello Tommy.
Good morning, how are you doing? All right.
Yeah, I'm not bad, thanks. Thanks for joining us. You're now manager of Spennymoor and the National League North, of course, which we're going to come back to in more detail later on. But I imagine you're itching to get going with it again.
I am, definitely. I mean, obviously the last two seasons have been cut short. The last season, very short. You know, we only played 13 league games. Our last game was December the 28th, which was against Gateshead away. It's been a nightmare, you know, obviously with COVID and no fans being allowed into the games. It hasn't been great, but obviously people's health and safety is the main thing. And just hopefully we can get fans back into the stadium when the new season begins and get back to some sort of normality.
Yeah, well, that's it. But, you know, safety, like you said, was paramount. But it was just odd how the National League kept going and the North and South had to stop.
It was, and like you say, all the teams in the National League are full-time, and us at Spennymoor were only part-time. I think there's about six clubs in our league who are full-time, and the rest of us part-time, and lads have jobs, so they go to their jobs during the day, then they come with us, and at our level, we weren't getting tested, which was a bit bizarre. So obviously, lads were mixing with other people at work, then coming to us on a Tuesday night and a Thursday night, and then obviously we were playing games on a Saturday. And it was spreading like wildfire, if I'm honest. And it was the right decision, definitely, to stop the season. And I know people who were up at the top were saying, well, we want to continue, we want to carry on and all that sort of stuff. We had games in hand. If we'd won the games in hand, I know hindsight's a wonderful thing, but if we'd won the games in hand, we could have been top of the league. But people's health was paramount and the right decision was made. And we just look forward to the new season where hopefully things can get back to normal.
Yeah, well, that's it. But we'll come back to all of that before we finish up. But I want to go back to your association with Sunderland. You kind of grew up following the lads. When did you start going to Roker then?
Started going to Roker Park when I was about probably 7-year-old, 8-year-old. From then, my dad was heavily involved with football. He used to scout for a lot of teams back in the day when he came out of the police force, and then he got involved with football. So I used to get a ticket with my dad. And then as I got on, sort of maybe 12, 13, I used to go with my friends and ended up going in the Roker end and, you know, in the Fowell end. I used to go in different parts of the ground and, I mean, good experiences. It was great sort of growing up and supporting your local team, really. And we all had our favourites back in the day, and Marco Gabbadini was certainly one of mine.
Yeah, it's funny, you know, you were going through that and I'm just kind of lost, kind of nodding, thinking, aye, exactly the same with me. Went about seven and, you know, went with people until I was old enough, then went with mates. And like you said, you know, it were different stands, you know, Roker Park had that, you know, it was falling to bits by the end, but it had that bit of magic, you know, every stand was different. And, you know, one day you went, oh, we'll go in here this week, lads. And it just had a bit something different to it, didn't it?
It did. I mean, when I went with my dad, we would normally be in the director's box where you had to be a little bit more quiet and a little bit more reserved, and you had to be dressed up a little bit more, shoes on, smarter to get in there. So I much preferred sort of mixing it with the fans and being able to sing songs and obviously cheering the lads on from behind the goal, really.
Yeah, that's it. And yeah, we could definitely do with a Mark Gore right now. But you were obviously kind of, you know, starting to play, and you had kind of plenty of trials with clubs when you were young. I mean, did Sunderland ever show any interest? Did we ever kind of, you know, did somebody ever kind of watch you and you thought, well, there might be a chance?
I think there was rumours that they were watching us. You know, I was at Hartlepool after I got released from Ipswich as a schoolboy. I did 2 years down there where I used to get the train down every other weekend to Ipswich, which is obviously a long way. Used to stay with the family on the Saturday night and then play in a game on the Sunday for the under-15s or the under-16s and then get the train home on the Sunday night ready for school the next day. After 2 years, I got released from Ipswich, one of the reasons being too small. I ended up going to Hartlepool, which was an unbelievable sort of learning curve for me, starting off at the bottom and trying to work my way back up. And luckily and fortunately, I did that. I had 2 great years in the YES scheme and then went on to be a professional and started doing well, started scoring a few goals. There was a rumoured interest from Sunderland, but there was never nothing concrete. And then I obviously ended up back at Ipswich.
Just going back to that Ipswich one, that originally, because, I mean, it was all a bit strange for a lot of years. Ipswich were really good, and they had a scout who worked with Bobby Robson, Charlie Woods, the guy who was a Charlie Woods.
Yeah, absolutely. Charlie Woods, a very big friend of Bobby Robson's. And from, he lives in Newcastle. He's back at Newcastle now, but yeah, a very good friend of Bobby Robson's, his sidekick, and he was a big chief scout, yeah, Charlie.
Yeah. For a long time, Ipswich used to take tons of players from the northeast. I mean, going back to Bobby Robson, you know, taking the likes of Eric Gates down there, and it's a fair old trek, but was it a good setup at the time?
Great setup. I mean, it's such a great club as well, such a family club. I mean, there were scouts all the time at our local Sunday team, which was Shotton Boys, where I grew up. My dad was the manager of that team, and there were scouts at our games a lot. Most Sundays, we had some very good footballers. A couple went on to make league appearances, but didn't quite make enough, but they did manage to play in the Football League, a couple of them. And Ipswich were prominent. You know, they were always at the games, and a fellow called Larry Phillips, who was from Seaham, he was the one who sort of said, listen, we want you to go down Ipswich on trial. And then later on, it was Colin Suggart, who was heavily involved in Ipswich as well, who sort of had a hand in me getting me moved back to Ipswich the second time.
Yeah, so like you said, you kind of came through at Hartlepool after that, made your debut. I think it was Mick Tate, wasn't it, who gave you your debut. How did you find that step up to kind of League Two at the time? Because I bet you it was kind of, you know, proper men down at League Two when you made that your debut.
It's proper football down at that level, and I wouldn't change anything. You know, my upbringing was brilliant from a football point of view. It was sort of sink or swim. You know, I got my debut because I'd been doing well for the youth team. I came on against Chester as a sub, and that was my first taste of it. We got beat 3-1 at the Diva Stadium, and then the week later, I made my full debut against Doncaster Rovers away at Bellevue, the old ground. We drew 2-2. I think we were getting beat 2-0. But you got no time on the ball. You're getting kicked from pillar to post. It toughened me up, and it was a fantastic grounding. And then after the games, during the week, you were cleaning seats, and I was, you know, sweeping stands, cleaning boots. It was all part and parcel of growing up in them days. And like I say, I wouldn't change it. It was a fantastic grounding for me, and such a great club, Hartlepool. You know, I'm delighted they've obviously getting back into the Football League. Just gone.
Yeah. It's funny, I don't think I've spoke to any ex-player who says that was a bad thing, you know, coming through when the apprentices did all the jobs and all of that sort of stuff. That I think to a man, they all say it was a good thing, and it's maybe something that's lost in the game now.
It's definitely lost. You know, I watch a lot of these academy games, and I speak to a lot of people, and they don't do anything these days, you know, and I think back in the day, it was part and parcel of it. You're mixing with the senior lads, but you're cleaning boots, you're doing your jobs, and then they'd give you a little tip at Christmas, and you'd sing in front of them, and it was just all part of growing up, the learning experience, and mixing you with senior professionals, and getting used to what it was all about. And like I say, I wouldn't change it. It was a fantastic grounding for me, and it's just a shame that the way the young lads now are sort of, I wouldn't say mollycoddled, but they're missing out on stuff like that, because it should still be around, I believe.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think you're the only one. You continued Hartlepool. Chris Turner had taken over by the summer of 2001. And by this time, you were kind of a wanted man, as you'd ended up as top scorer, I think, two seasons in a row. I mean, just looking at that last season at Hartlepool, 2000-2001, you scored 20 goals in kind of League Two. And, you know, we'll see that goals from midfield is a running theme as we kind of go through your career. But if you had to kind of describe yourself as a player, would you say that kind of your biggest asset was kind of getting forward from midfield and getting those goals?
Absolutely. I mean, when I got into the first team initially through Mick Tier, I think he was unsure what I was, and I was unsure what I was, because sometimes I would play just in front of the defenders, try to set the play up and get on the ball, whereas other times he'd let me get forward. And then Chris Turner came in and sort of gave me a position and stuck to it. The formation suited us superbly, and I was just given a license to get forward. He'd obviously seen in training that I could finish, I could score goals, and he wanted that to happen on a weekend and happen on a Saturday, and he gave me a license, like I say, to get forward, give me freedom and get in the box, and I managed to score goals. And obviously I owe Chris a lot, because he gave me that opportunity. And obviously players around me, it doesn't work if you haven't got the right players around you. And I had lads behind me who would do my defensive work as such, you know, like some Mark Tinkler, Paul Stevenson, good experienced professionals and good players to play with. And, you know, I owe them a lot as well, because it gave me the freedom and give me sort of, it was my time to flourish, and I did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And like I said, you're a wanted man in the summer of 2001. And, you ended up signing for George Burley in Ipswich Town for $750,000, which looking back, I mean, for a 22-year-old playing in Division 3, as it was, or League 2 in today's money, I mean, that's a big fee. And Ipswich had just finished fifth in the Premier League, so that must have been a huge move at the time.
It was massive. I think there was three or four clubs who had come in, and I went to speak to a few, and I was close to sort of signing for Coventry under Gordon Strachan. They were doing pretty well at the time. But once I went back to Ipswich and spoke to George Burley, he mentioned there they'd just finished fifth in the Premier League. They qualified for Europe. Now, I knew I was going there and I'd have to bide my time, and I knew I wouldn't get much game time. I was going from Division 3 to the Premier League, and it was a massive, massive jump. But I knew the club from my brief time there as a schoolboy. I knew how well people got looked after. I knew the area as such, and I just thought this was an opportunity I couldn't turn down. And I'd gone from sort of watching these players on Match of the Day to training with them and to playing with them, and it was pretty surreal. But it was definitely the right step for me, and like you say, it was definitely the right decision. It's a fantastic club.
Yeah, and I'd imagine that helped that you weren't going into the unknown, like you said. And I mean, again, great players in that squad: Herman Wrightson, Jim McGilton, Matt Holland, Chris Makin, obviously from a Sunderland point of view, Marcus Stewart as well, Titus Bramble, the mythical Fanini George, and a young Darren Bent and a very young Darren Ambrose as well. And so as you said, that conversation with George Burley, did he said, look, you know, you're kind of 22. Bit of time to bed in, and then I'll want to say you're pushing for the first team. Is that kind of how that conversation went?
Definitely. And in pre-season, we went, I can't remember where we went now. I don't know if we went to Austria or somewhere, or Finland. And I remember it was one of my first games, and I was on the pitch and I was just bombing forward every time, doing what I only know, really. And I remember George sort of pulling me at the end of the game, and he was saying, listen, I'm delighted with how you're playing. I think I scored as well in the actual game. And he just went, listen, I'm delighted with how you did, but we need to pull the reins on you a little bit. You know, you're getting forward at every opportunity you possibly can. Sometimes you need to just sort of hold your runs and let others go and make sure you get the right timings right and don't go all the time. And so I did have to adapt slightly, and I did have to bide my time. I was games were few and far. I made me full debut, well, coming off the bench, sorry, in Russia as a substitute in the UEFA Cup, which again was another crazy experience, surreal. We managed to win the game against Torpedo Moscow, and then, like I say, chances after that were few and far between. Got in towards the back end of the season when the team were sort of fighting relegation. And in hindsight, Ipswich getting relegated probably, is, I wouldn't say it was the best thing that could have happened to me, but it obviously worked in my favour, because I knew that bigger stars, bigger names would move on, because Ipswich would have to cut the cloth accordingly. And then I knew that the Championship was going to be my time to shine, and my opportunity of really nailing down a first team place and making a mark.
Yeah. You mentioned that you kind of came in that UEFA Cup campaign. I mean, I think you made your debut against Helsingborgs, I think early that season. I think it was the November. Because it's always kind of talked about with Ipswich, because they tried to kick on that year after finishing fifth and qualifying for the UEFA Cup. And it's always blamed purely on them qualifying for the UEFA Cup that they went down the next season. I mean, is it kind of a bit overblown, or did it have a huge impact that year?
I think a little bit of it was. I mean, I don't think you can solely blame it on that. Maybe the squad wasn't big enough in terms of numbers. Second season syndrome, as they say, you know, on such a high, finishing fifth in the Premier League, and the next season sort of teams have worked you out a little bit. They know what you're all about. They know how you play. Whereas the first season you're in the Premier League, you're a bit unknown, and you're coming in with a bit of momentum from the promotion winning season the year before. So I wouldn't necessarily put it down to the UEFA Cup, because it was a fantastic experience in the UEFA Cup. At the end of the day, you are where you are in the league because you haven't been good enough over the course of the season. It's as simple as that. And unfortunately, Ipswich got relegated and players moved on. And then it was a bit of a rebuild job and in administration as well later. So it was strange times. But from a personal point of view, it gave me an opportunity to really set me mark and get a mark in the team and nail a place in the Championship.
Yeah, like you said, you played 13 games in the Premier League, most of them as sub, and then that next season in the Championship, finished seventh, just missed out on the playoffs. But you played 37 games and scored 10 goals from midfield, which was your first full season at that level. But that season, bit of turmoil. George Burley was sacked in the October, replaced by Joe Royle. I mean, for you, that was your first full season at kind of that level. Was it a strange time, especially for the club, because George Burley had been there for, like, you know, I think he'd been there for about 8 years or something, and then, you know, then it was all changed to Joe Royle. So was that a strange time for you, even though it was a successful season in terms of you playing so many games?
Yeah, it was a strange time because obviously I owe George Burley a lot, because he was the one who gambled and spent the money on me. And, you know, not many clubs to this day will go and get someone from the lower leagues and spend that money on them. And the jump, like I say, is a big jump. So George, I owe a lot, you know, a great manager. And sometimes when you've been at a club for so long, the time is probably right to change. And it was a big, big shock at the club as a whole, because George was part of the furniture. And obviously he played there as well. And he's a hero, you know. He got them out of the league. He got them into the Premier League. He got them fifth. And I think he got Manager of the Year as well, yeah. Premier League Manager of the Year. So 12 months later, 18 months later, he's out of a job and he's getting the sack, but that's football and it shouldn't surprise you. And as much as we were disappointed he went, you've got to move on quickly in football. And Joe Royle comes in. And again, I owe Joe a lot, because Joe probably gave me the license again, what Chris Turner gave me at Hartlepool. He played a system where you get forward. And I was lucky that I had players behind me who could do the defensive side of things. And it was the best time in my career playing under Joe Royle, certainly.
Yeah, because, I mean, Joe Royle after Ipswich, I think he briefly managed Oldham a few years later, but that was his last job really in football. And he was kind of one of that generation who played in the 60s and 70s, maybe quite a few of them coming to the end of their kind of management careers around that time. I mean, on paper, you know, looking from the outside, he was appears probably that he was a bit old school, but would that be fair on Joe Royle?
Joe Royle was, I mean, he had Willie Donaghy alongside him, who was his assistant, and them two were just the perfect match, chalk and cheese. You know, Joe, very laid back, very sort of friendly fella, but could obviously go if needed be, you know, could absolutely go mental if things weren't working out in the game or in training. But Willie was very hands-on with the training, you know, coaching, very methodical, very serious. And like I say, the pair of them worked ever so well together. And training was enjoyable, and obviously the games were enjoyable, because from my point of view, we were an all-out attacking team. We had goals in us. If we'd score six, yes, the opposition sometimes might get four or five and they'd be close games, and obviously fans would be looking at it thinking, oh God, but we were known as the entertainers. You know, we did go out and we'd put a show on and we'd be all-out attack, and we got close, you know, with the playoffs 2 years on the bounce. And it's just a shame we couldn't get over the line, because I'm not saying we deserve to, because obviously you finish where you finish, but it was a bit of a disaster in how it all ended, and that we missed out and got beat off West Ham 2 years on the bounce in the playoffs.
Yeah, I found that amazing that you got beat off the same club twice in a row. But and like I say, I mean, you've obviously been in a free license, because in that second season you played 50 games, scored 15 goals, but you're out of contract at the end of the season. I think you'd had kind of 4 years there. I mean, did you feel during that season it might be time to move on? Because again, lots of clubs were interested that summer.
I didn't. You know, I spoke to Joe a lot, sort of from January onwards. He was aware of my contract coming to an end, as obviously I was. And he just said, listen, we obviously want to keep you, but talks with new deals and stuff like that are on hold until we know what division we're going to be in, so we can't do anything. And that was myself, and there was a few others as well, you know, who were sort of coming towards the end of the contract. And if Joe Royal and the club had said, listen, there's a contract, we want you, and we'd get it sorted in January, February, I'd have signed it. There's no doubt about it, because I was loving my football, and why would I want to move? Yes, I was doing well, but I thought I could get to the Premier League with Ipswich. There was no reason why we couldn't. We were going very well. So it was one of them. And we ended up getting beat in the playoffs. And again, hindsight is a wonderful thing. Sunderland get promoted. Sunderland all of a sudden showing a bit of interest. I'm available on a free. I'm a local lad. I know Sunderland is a club in how big it is. And I obviously get me moved to Sunderland, and I shake hands with Joe Royal, and you move on. And he wouldn't stand in my way, obviously, because I was out of contract, and also it was an opportunity to play in the Premier League.
Yeah, yeah. And I think, you know, it's common knowledge, you know, Celtic and Leeds were interested, obviously being out of contract. And you decided in the end to join Sunderland. We won the championship that year, so we were a Premier League club again. Plus, I heard, I think, on Under the Cosh, which is a belter, I enjoyed that one, that podcast you did. Mick McCarthy was apparently stalking you in Portugal, which I think might have been, had something to do with it. But I mean, you were kind of 26 years old at the time as well, kind of probably coming into your prime. I mean, was that move all about the emotion of coming back to Sunderland, you know, a team you supported as a kid? Or was there also, did you have to kind of put your football, you know, I'm a player as well, that kind of that hat on as well to kind of decide what you were going to do?
I think both. I think it was definitely emotion was involved in it. Boyhood club, pull the red and white shirt on, you're getting back home, you're back north, family still there. You know, you're 4 hours away at Ipswich. It's not exactly around the corner. And it was, I'd been there for 4 years at Ipswich, and it was probably time to come home as such. And it was an opportunity I certainly couldn't turn down. You mentioned Celtic, you mentioned Leeds, and I'll be honest with you, Leeds chucked an unbelievable contract at me. It was longer. There was more money involved. I would have been better financially, but Sunderland was the dream, really. You know, Sunderland, they were in the Premier League. Like I say, they'd just been promoted to the Premier League, and it was an opportunity I couldn't have turned down. And I'd went on holiday to Portugal, and there was all rumours flying around. And then I get a phone call off Mick, who was in Portugal as well. And he came across to meet me, and the deal was more or less done in Portugal. It was, he didn't have to sell the club to me. I knew what it was all about, and I knew how big it was. And I knew the fan base and all sorts, and it was just a case of getting everything done in terms of contract, and it was done pretty much very quickly, and I couldn't wait to sign.
Yeah, I'm still in two minds whether that was a coincidence or not. No, Mick McCarthy.
Well, Mick's got a holiday home out there, or he did. He's still got it, so he's always in Portugal, always in Portugal.
Yeah, so I mean that discussion that you had with them, because obviously they've kind of just been promoted, but was that discussion around, you know, look, you know, we're making a big step up, and you know, it was a kind of acceptance on both sides that it was going to be a tough season, because you know, any team that gets promoted, there's always going to be that huge gap to kind of try and leap over, you know, when you get promoted to the Premier League.
It is a big step, and if you're not given money to spend on players, it's going to be a struggle. You definitely need money to spend in the Premier League. And as it happens, it was a struggle. You know, the players that we brought in, probably weren't good enough, and I include myself in that. As a squad, we weren't good enough. You know, yes, we had a few moments, but very few and far between. And as I've said earlier, when I was at Ipswich, the table doesn't lie, and you are where you are. And it was a tough season, a very tough season. And it wasn't for lack of effort, certainly, or desire or anything like that. It was just a lack of quality overall. And it was disappointing. It ended disappointingly that season.
Yeah. Well, I mean, when you walked in kind of that dressing room, because we had a really young squad that Mick McCarthy had done absolute wonders with to get us up, you know, probably against the odds. If you look at, you know, where he bought half of those players from, you know, within the lower leagues and all of that. And he brought them in and kind of built that squad together, and they were all really young and didn't have too much experience. But I mean, was everyone still upbeat on the back of that promotion season, or was there a bit of, could you feel everyone was a bit apprehensive about, okay, we're making this step up now?
I think obviously they were on the high, and as the pre-season goes on, you're sort of waiting for some big names to come into the building, or bigger names. So you're maybe waiting for Mick to spend a bit of money and to get a bit of backing, and it just didn't happen. You know, yes, players came in, but were they Mick's really top priorities or top targets? I think he probably might have wanted better, or he wanted bigger names. I'm not sure. And he didn't get backed like he should have been backed. And I look at some of the managers over the last, five, six, seven, 8 years even, I mean, and they've been given money to spend. You know, you have to look at the Roy Keane era, and they've been given money to spend. It would have been great if Mick was given half as much as some of them, you know, to spend, because I'm sure he'd have kept Sunderland up in the Premier League. And it's just a shame, because Mick's a really good guy, honest, tells you how it is. And I was delighted to sign for him, delighted to play for Sunderland. But touching back, it's funny, because I've gone from a team in Ipswich where we're all out of tack to a team that's gone into the Premier League. Now, I'm not expecting Sunderland to go in the Premier League and be open and attack in numbers, because it's a different ball game in the Premier League. But I knew straight away in pre-season that my game was going to have to change, because I wasn't given the license to get forward. We were playing a different system. We were playing 4-4-2 or 4-4-1-1, whereas at Ipswich we played like a 4-3-3 or a 4-4 sort of two, but I was just given freedom, get forward. We played like a 4-2-4 in Ipswich more or less all the time, you know, get forward as much as you can. But so I knew I would have to adapt my game, and Dean Whitehead was alongside me in midfield, and then we brought Christopher Sear in as well. And Dean all liked to get forward. He was a real box-to-box, and I knew that both of us couldn't get forward. Carl Robinson was in and around it as well, and then he obviously moved on. So I knew my game would have to change, and he probably didn't get the best of me in what he wanted me to do. And that's not me being harsh on Mick or any excuses. It's just he didn't see the best of him because of how we set up. But then again, the Premier League is a different ballgame. All I'm saying is if Ipswich had getting promoted, there's no doubt about it, Joe Royal wouldn't have changed his way or his style. Yes, listen, we might have got beat and we might have ended up getting relegated with Ipswich, but I think my game or whatever certainly would have been better, because I was probably suited to Joe Royal's style of football, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it's funny actually, because you were talking there, and I mean, we kind of saw it in flashes, because I'm kind of thinking 25th of September away to Middlesbrough live on Sky. It was our first win of the season, seventh attempt. But for, you know, 2 minutes in, you got the first goal, and it's a kind of, I think Kelvin Davis long, I think it was a goal kick or free kick or something. Kelvin Davis pumped the ball up forward, but if you look at when the ball lands. And I can't remember who was playing up front, but there's basically three players up front. Andy Gray, and I can't remember who his partner was, but there was three up front, and you were basically, you were kind of beyond the two strikers, because they ended up a kind of ping pong between a couple of players and ended up kind of dropping to your feet, and instinctively you hit it and it went in off the post. But it seemed like, you know, like you said, in flashes, you would go, right, okay, I'm going to make that move that probably felt natural to you. At the time, and that was your game.
Yeah, it was, and that was my game, and obviously that was a good moment for me, you know, obviously scoring your first goal in the Premier League and for your boyhood club, and to beat Middlesbrough, who I know are not the big derby, but it's still a bit of a derby, you know, the Tees Weir derby. So I was delighted. And then obviously Arthur curled a free kick in and we won the game 2-0. And you just think, right, this is the chance now. Can we kick on and can we push on? But again, we didn't. And the season was a struggle and frustrating and very disappointing.
Yeah, the word you used there, frustrating, and I think that sums it up for me more than anything else, because, I mean, most games were by the odd goal. In a lot of the games, we were actually in the game, but, you know, something happened, or there was a mistake, or sort of a bit of brilliance from the opposition, and we just couldn't seem to get a result. But it wasn't like we were getting battered week after week.
No, I mean, we like I said earlier, it wasn't for lack of desire or effort. It was just maybe that little bit of quality what we lacked. And you said mistakes. We had mistakes, you know, which didn't help. And you do a mistake in the Premier League and you're going to get punished, you know, because you're playing against better players, better quality. And you might get away with it in the Championship, but in the Premier League, you certainly don't. And we paid for it 100%. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah, and actually just on that Middlesbrough game, it maybe sums things up, but my overriding memory of that game is Nairon Nosworthy conceding a corner from the halfway line. But that's,
I remember that as well. Maybe not clear, but I do remember that one. Yeah, I do remember that.
With his left foot, but maybe a sign of the times. About a month later, I mean, this again, just kind of sums up the season a little bit, because a month later we went to St James's Park to face Gribsunis' Newcastle side. Obviously yourself, you know, being from the area, growing up with this rivalry, you probably had a better idea of what it was like than most of the others in the squad at the time. But how did you find being, you know, the build-up to the game and being involved in that game? Because, I mean, I know like me, you've probably been to so many kind of growing up.
Unbelievable experience. I mean, the week leading up to it, it just builds and builds and builds as the day gets closer. You know, lots of friends are on the phone, lots of family members, you know, you better beat them. You see people in the street, it means everything. It is a proper derby. And I've been lucky enough to play in some good derbies, you know, throughout my career. The Sheffield derby, which is massive. Ipswich Norwich, which is a derby. Even Swindon v Oxford was pretty hostile, if I'm honest with you. But that is a proper derby, Sunderland Newcastle. And, you know, as the bus pulls up, you know, the fans are on the street and they shout and stuff. Like, yeah, I mean, it is a special derby. And the atmosphere at Newcastle and at Sunderland, you know, is special. And we just got beat. I think Emery scored a free kick. It's Newcastle, you know, St James is in. I think it finished 3-2. So we come close, you know, but I mean, no one remembers the losers, and it means everything to the fans, you know, if you can win the derby. And good game to play in, but obviously not the outcome we wanted, not the result.
Yeah. But again, I mean, I thought, you know, my memories, you know, probably might, well, faded a bit, but I remember us being brilliant this day. I mean, we really kind of took it to them, and, you know, Stephen Elliott scored a fantastic goal to make it 2s each. I think you had
Lee
to be
Lawrence a... scored as well, didn't he? I think Lee
he
Lawrence
did.
Scored as well, didn't he? Yeah, he scored a great goal as well, I think.
And I think you had to be a good lad, because you got booked after about 20 minutes. I think.
So you've got to be careful after that. Maybe he's getting a bit too excited. But it was a good game of playing, and like you say, we come close, you know, we played some decent stuff, and it was a really entertaining derby. But, you know, a bit of magic from Emery, the Turkish midfielder, he curls one in, top corner, free kick, and like you say, 3-2, and we lost out on it again on a narrow defeat.
Yeah, again, saw that so many times a season, but it goes on like that, and went to March, and we're rock bottom, and we'd won twice up to about March, and then Mick McCarthy got sacked. And it's one of these quirks in football that, you know, Mick McCarthy did such a good job to turn the club around after our relegation before that. Took a couple of seasons, completely rebuilt the squad with young players, players from the lower leagues. And it's one of those that, you know, if he doesn't get Sunderland promoted, he might keep his job for 4, 5, 6 years. But he gets promoted, doesn't get the backing, and then gets sacked. So he's kind of a victim of his own success. And it's such a strange quirk that can happen in football. It happens so often.
It does. You know, you never know what's around the corner in football. I mean, in life as well. But in football, certainly. You know, you're on a high 1 minute, you're winning games, and then the next you're getting beaten. It's just a massive lull and lower. And what Mick did for the club, he obviously got them into the Premier League, and it was a struggle. But if the club was heading to the Championship and getting relegated, there was probably no one better than Mick to get them back up, to maybe rebuild and to have another go at it. Once he got the sack, and we moved on, and Bawley came in and sort of did the remainder of the season. And like you say, the writing was on the wall because of the poor results we'd had all season. And it was only a matter of time, really, before relegation was confirmed.
Yeah. Like you said, Kevin Ball did take over, and obviously a bit of a legend at the club. But you surprised he's never been given a crack at the job?
I am, because he is a legend of the club. You know, he's a fantastic man as well. And he always looks out for you. You know, he'll always back you. He'll always support you. He's the heartbeat of Sunderland Football Club. And just touching on Kevin Ball, actually, I'd like to pay my respects to Louise Wanless, who was the media girl there. She helped me a lot when I first signed, as she's helped many of players who's been new to the club. And she would be an absolutely massive miss to the football club, because she was the heartbeat of it. She would do anything for you, like I said, and such a tragic way to go, you know. And I know she's been poorly, and like I said, I'd just like to send my respect to her and her family, really. But touching back on Bawley, yeah, I'm a bit surprised that he hasn't been given an opportunity now. Whether he's wanted this, I don't know. You know, you'd have to ask him that, but he is a legend of the football club.
Yeah, and I'll second that on Louise as well. I mean, some of the tributes are absolutely fantastic that came through from all areas, you know, clubs and journalists, and yeah, absolutely fantastic. Yeah. But again, you know, that towards the end of that season, I mean, just, you know, we talked about the signings, but I mean, kind of, you know, like yourself, I mean, we signed quite a few players, you know, Calvin Davis in goal, and, you know, go through some of the others, Andy Gray, etc. But none of them really kicked on. But actually, just a side point on that, in terms of kicking on, I mean, you were actually joint top scorer that season in the Premier League with three goals. But I mean, just thinking about the signings, I mean, do you think that they weren't able to kick on just because the impact that season had on people, because that season was just kind of so brutal for everyone involved, whether it was fans, players or whatever?
Yeah, I mean, listen, all the players who were signed on paper, all very good, you know, all done very well in the Championship. I think Steady had a little spell at Blackburn where he'd done really well in the Premier League. You know, Andy Gray had played there before as well. So all good signings on paper and all looking to obviously flourish, and it just didn't work, whether it was the way we were set up, whether it was the whole team, you know, the dynamics of the team, it didn't happen. And we, like I said, we weren't good enough overall, lack of quality, but certainly wasn't for the lack of effort, as I've said before. But disappointing, that's all I can say really on that. Also, the pressures probably that come with it as well. I mean, Sunderland is a very, very tough place to play. Listen, and this is not an excuse whatsoever, because I've been to other clubs and they're tough place. And you've got to be mentally strong. Now, if you're not, you will fall by the wayside. There's no doubt about it. But at the same time, if things are going right, there's no better place than in front of the Sunderland fans. So it works both ways. And yes, if you went a goal down and all of a sudden you're on a bad run, and it can affect people. It can affect players. Mentally, some players are not as strong as others, and maybe that didn't help the game. You know, confidence was low and all sorts of stuff. But listen, there's no excuses. There's no excuses whatsoever. But that is a point which I think is quite valid.
Yeah, I mean, specifically for you, just on that point. I mean, because I mean, obviously being a fan of the club, I mean, does it have a different feeling than when you're playing for a club that you've got no history with and you can kind of purely focus on the football? Because, you know, it must be strange that you've almost got the weight of friends and family who are following the club home and away. And it's got to have a different feeling about it than when you're playing for a club that you've got absolutely no history with.
That's an excellent point, and it's 100% right in my eyes, because you have lads who come in and maybe they don't get the feel of the club. You know, they don't feel the love of the club, and they maybe living away as well. They're sort of travelling a couple of hours, and as soon as they leave the training ground, they're out of here, they're away from us. Whereas you had the likes of myself, and listen, there's been other local players who's played for the club, Grant Ledbetter. There's plenty. There's too many to mention. You're in and around it, you know, and you probably do feel the pressure more because you're hearing it more from fans, friends, family. They're on you. What's happening here? Why are you doing this? Why? What's going on? And again, you've got to be mentally strong and you've got to overcome that. And I like to think I am mentally strong, and you try not to let it affect you. But in the back of your mind, you're still hearing it and you're still aware of it. It's a very valid point that what you've brought up. I think lads who are local and lads who are more connected to the club do feel it more.
Goes into the summer of 2006. Then we have takeover with Alcuin's consortium. Although his search for a manager wasn't going that well, obviously. But there must have been massive uncertainty, you know, for yourself, for everybody. Just being relegated, new owners, you don't know what they're going to do. There's no manager. Alcuin's trying to take it on, but he's giving out all the lines in public saying, well, I'm not going to do it forever. I'm getting someone who's, you know, world class. He's this, he's that. I mean, it must have been a strange time, really kind of uncertain time for all the squad at that time.
It was. The club was in a mess, if I'm totally honest with you. Pre-season was a bit of a shambles as such, you know. We were hearing all sorts of rumours about what was going on, who was going to be the manager. We didn't have a manager. People were helping out. Niall Quinn was the chairman, stroke manager. We went down to Bath University. We went there for pre-season. We played a couple of games. We did some training, but it was a bit of a sort of mismatch. No one knew what was going on. And ideally, when you get relegated, you need a decision made straight away. You need a manager in place for pre-season, and you need to get his ideas across. He needs to bring his players in, and nothing was happening. No one knew who was going to be the manager. Was Niall going to do it? Was he not? Yes, he was helping out. Did he want it? Did he not? And like I said, it was a bit of a shambles, a bit of a mess. And then we go into the season, and we didn't start the season very well at all. You know, the first three games, we played Plymouth at home. I think I get injured early doors, had to come off with my ankle ligament. And then I'm out for 6 weeks after that. Shortly after that Plymouth game, I think Roy Keane was appointed and announced, which was an unbelievable, you know, statement from the club, backed by the owners who were going to spend money. So everything was appearing to be great. This Sunderland's going to be back up again. This is massive, you know, excellent, going in the right direction. And from a personal point of view, watching it all unfold from the treatment room, and in his first week, I think he brought Bowen and I think three of them were midfielders, Dwight York, Liam Miller, Graham Kavanagh. And I'm, as much as I'm excited and thinking, yes, brilliant, I'm thinking, hang on a minute, is the whole sort of ethos of the club was changing, and he was meaning business, and he had money to spend, and he was going to bring players in. And I was thinking, is this a sort of sign that it might be hard for me to get in the team when I'm fit, when I'm back?
Yeah. Was it just kind of really bad timing, and the fact that you were kind of out of sight, out of mind when you were out in these first few weeks?
It definitely was. You know, because when a new manager comes in, you want to hit the ground running, you want to be praying, and you want to show him what you can do. You want to, you know, impress him. And from the treatment room, you're not impressing anyone. And managers will sort of, managers are different, but Roy was, he didn't have to any time for anyone who was injured because they were no good for him. You know, they were irrelevant to what he was trying to do at that time. And it wasn't just myself, but other lads who were injured, and yeah, they were no good for him at that time, and players were coming in, and he just liked to work with the lads who were fit and able, which is perfect for him.
Yeah, and then you end up going out on loan to Preston, and then come back to the stadium a lot in December, and then help Preston to a 1-0 win through a David Nugent goal, and you had a blinder. But after the game, was there not any kind of reaction from the Sunderland lads saying, you know, what the beat were you playing for?
It was bizarre. It was absolutely bizarre. I mean, Ipswich had come in for me to go on loan as well, and it was a case of Ipswich, Preston. Preston was closer to where I was living, easier for me. My wife had just had twins who were premature. So Roy Roy wasn't happy with that because I had a week off. I said, listen, the wife's in hospital, not very well. The babies have just been born, the twins, premature. But Roy being Roy, that's irrelevant. You know, it's football or nothing. And I had a week off and I don't think he was happy with that. I spent some time with the family and obviously in the hospital, obviously worried, concerned. And then after that, I was training well, doing all I could, and I just didn't get an opportunity. The team had begun to pick up. The team was doing quite well. He seemed to have getting his team sorted and looking all right. I was knocking on the door, but obviously not hard enough. And I decided to go to Preston, and I knew in the agreement that we were playing, Preston were playing Sunderland at the Stadium of Light. And the week leading up, Paul Simpson, the Preston manager, was saying, have you heard from Roy? And I said, no, I've heard nothing. Not heard anything from the club. No, I've heard nothing. I said, well, there's nothing in this agreement to say you aren't allowed to play. I said, well, that's how it is. And I keep saying this, Roy being Roy, he's not bothered. He doesn't care. You know, he's his own man. And come Saturday, I'm in the team for Preston against Sunderland. And it was very bizarre because on one hand, I'm wanting, obviously, Preston to win because I'm playing for Preston. On the other hand, I'm a Sunderland fan and I'm a Sunderland player, contracted to Sunderland. And I'm thinking, what am I doing here? Why am I playing in this game? And it was very, very strange. And Preston scored. We scored a goal. And I sort of jumped up just as a sort of instant reaction, normal reaction, sort of punch the air or whatever. Because we'd scored, we'll win them 1-0. And I got a bit of stick for that, which, listen, fans are entitled to it. And a bit of criticism, but that is a natural reaction. And it was more aimed at Roy Keane because he let me go on loan. He let me play against his team. And I think at half-time and full-time, he said to the lads, listen, we've been beaten by a team there and their best player on the pitch was probably one of ours, i.e. myself. And after that, he recalled me, said that I was going to get an opportunity. But again, we were. It didn't happen. I was on the bench a few times and didn't get on. And I think Barnes, yeah, came on as a sub towards the end. But the team was doing well, which I can understand. The opportunities were limited, but I could maybe have stayed at Preston and seen the season out there, but he recalled me because he thought maybe I could help them get over the line. But we did in the end, but I didn't play much of a part.
Mm. Yeah, did you, when he recalled you and you had those few games on the bench, did you think you had a sniff of getting back in?
I did, you know, because I was in and around and he was sort of making me feel as if I was going to get a chance. But the team was doing well. You know, the team was doing well and it was moving up the table. And like I say, I was doing everything I could in training. But sometimes your face doesn't fit or he gets something in his head. And that's life. There's no sort of hard feelings and there's no fallout with Roy Keane or anything like that. It was just sometimes your face doesn't fit. He brings players in. They do well. You move on. That's football.
Yeah, that's it. You were out of contract at the end of the season, so were there just any conversations with the club about that, or had you decided earlier on that, it's time to move on?
No, I mean, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to work out what was going to happen. Mm. I wasn't playing much. Mm. I was out of contract. I knew I'd be moving on. It was just a case of where I would go and what the next step would be. And I ended up going back to Ipswich. Again, I could have went to Leeds. There was an opportunity for me to go to Leeds where I wouldn't have had to move house. But because Jim McGilton was the Ipswich manager, I'd played with him, a good friend of mine. The decision was to go back to Ipswich and off I went for a third spell.
Was that a bit weird, playing for someone who was your mate and you had a bit of a laugh with as a player and then suddenly he's the manager?
It was. It definitely was at first. It took a little bit of a while to adjust. You know, Jim could trust me. He trusted me as a player when he played in the team alongside me. And then obviously he's brought me in and he wanted me to step up to the mark and sort of run the dressing room a little bit and be his eyes and ears for him. And he was new to it. He was learning as well. He was learning on the job. It was all new to him. It was his next step in his career, jumping from player to coach to managing. And he made mistakes because he was learning on the job, but he also got things right. And he's a fantastic guy, you know, and very passionate. You know, he wears his heart on his sleeve, and what you see is what you get with Jimmy. He's very passionate. He plays the game the right way. And again, another one who, obviously, you know who came in after Jim when Jim moved on, and was given a lot of money to spend. And if Jim had, again, I know hindsight's a wonderful thing in football, but if Jim had been given money to spend, he would have gotten Ipswich definitely promoted, because they weren't far away. They weren't knocking on the door. They were not far away at all.
Yeah, well, that's it. He had a good couple of years at Ipswich, and then, like I said, Jim Magilton was on the way out. Roy Keane came in. You made the move to Sheffield Wednesday, which was all a bit odd. I think it was a really bad time for Sheffield Wednesday. A huge kind of turnaround, and linked up with Mickey Gray. So at Sheffield Wednesday, but yeah, not a good time for Sheffield Wednesday. Then you moved on to Huddersfield, played with Lee Clark. And just talk quickly on Lee Clark, actually, because obviously at the time, you know, real ambitious kind of manager trying to make his way in football management. Quite rightly, kind of lauded at the time, you know, 53 game unbeaten run. But I mean, we were talking earlier about Mick McCarthy and, you know, maybe getting up too soon, victim of his own success. And it's a sign of, you know, the way it turned for Lee Clark, you know, when he got the sack there, when they were fourth after a 53 game unbeaten run. And then, you know, I think, you know, and kind of ends up at kind of Blythe Spartans and managing there. But it just shows what football can do and how quickly it can turn like that.
It does. You know, nothing surprises you in football, or it shouldn't, because Lee Clark was, again, with Huddersfield the year before I went, they were in the playoffs and just missed out on getting promotion. And the following season, I'd gone in and he said, listen, we need to get over the line. This is a big season. We just need to push on from the season before and try and do it. And we went 53 games unbeaten. Obviously, it rolled over from the season before I was there. But it's an unbelievable achievement. You know, an unbelievable achievement to go that long without losing a game is ridiculous if you think about it. So I think we're fourth, and there was all sorts of rumours where Lee wasn't happy, the chairman wasn't happy, and we couldn't believe it when he got the sack. It came totally out of the blue. Big surprise, big shock. And because he's a great guy, another one who wears his heart on his sleeve, good coach, you know, fiery at times. But listen, a lot of managers have that in them. But treat the players well, and disappointed to see him go. But again, you kind of dwell on it because another man comes in the door soon after, and he was the man to sort of try and get us over the line, a proven track winner at getting teams out of League One and getting them promoted. And Simon Grayson came in, and I know it didn't work out well at Sunderland for him, certainly not, but he got the job done at Huddersfield. We went up through the playoffs and final, and great way to go up. Obviously disappointing if you're on the losing side, but he got the job done, and he got them over the line, which was great for him and great on a personal level and great for the club.
Yeah. And then it was on to Swindon Town, and maybe a relaxing time with a certain Paolo Di Canio. and I've heard, yeah, I mean, stories of something good, you know, kind of full of stories, people who kind of played under Paolo Di Canio wherever he was. And I talked, you know, I've heard you talk about how intense it was on the fitness side of things, but also, I mean, you've said the other side, you've said how much you enjoyed playing under him and how much you were kind of learning. So, I mean, aside from the crazy stories, I mean, how good was he tactically? Because the amount of people who said, oh yeah, you know, he did this, which was crazy, but I tell you what, he knows his stuff, and like, I learned a lot from him.
I loved playing under him. I really did. I was there for, well, 9 months I think I had with him, and then obviously walked out in bizarre circumstances. But the minute I met him was the minute I knew I wanted to play for him, just because of who he is, absolute legend, and just how he spoke and how he saw the game. And he did say to me that there'd be no days off when I went to sign, and I was like, surely you get days off. And he was like, no, this Wednesday, mentality of Wednesday off in England, no chance, we work hard. And I thought, nah, I'm not buying into that. Anyway, he was right. We days off were very few and far between, if any. Anyway, from a coaching point of view, fantastic. Yes, training was a little bit like Groundhog Day from week to week. You knew what you were doing on certain days, but he would leave nothing unturned. He was very, very good tactically. He would go through everything on the opposition in great detail. And come Saturday or come a Tuesday night, whenever you were playing, there was no excuse in how the opposition play, how they set up, what your job entailed from a personal point of view, from a team point of view. He was very, very good. And I learned so much from him in that short space of time. His man management skills, as you know, and as everyone knows, and as you've heard stories, was questionable. At Swindon, they could get away with it because there wasn't as many big egos. You know, lads weren't on as much money as obviously when he went to Sunderland. And I knew if he didn't change at Sunderland, he wouldn't last much. He wouldn't last long because you have bigger egos there. Lads who's on bigger contracts, and lads who are probably not going to go along with them, and maybe not agree with certain methods. Where at Swindon, it was working. We were top of the league or second in the league, and we were all buying into what he was telling us and what he believed. And it was, like I said, it was working. And like I said, on occasion, he'd go ballistic. And there was Sunday morning at 6 o'clock where you're in watching games from the Saturday and telling you what you did wrong. And yes, he should have and could have approached it in different ways. But that was him. You know, he would... Like I say, and he couldn't change, and he didn't change at Sunderland from a man management point of view. But it's just a shame he's not involved in football, because he has a lot to offer from a coaching point of view. Very, very good with the defenders. You know, as much as he was an attacker, the Italian sort of back four, very strict, no gaps. Just very, very good man to work under. And like I say, I loved playing for him. But I could write a book on him in terms of everything that went on. You know, it was crazy time. But like I said, I did love playing for him.
Yeah, obviously you mentioned he obviously went to Sunderland. But at the time, you know, looking in from the outside, were you kind of intrigued to see if it would work, or did you just think, nah, there's no chance? And it'd be gone in a few weeks.
I knew it wouldn't. Yeah, I knew it wouldn't work if he didn't change from a man management point of view. That was a definite. Whether he could change, I was unsure. I didn't think he would, and obviously he didn't by the sounds of it. But the moment when he ran down the line at St. James's Park and he slid on his knees will live in many a memory of Sunderland fans. What a moment. You know, he with his suit trousers on and he just slid, and I mean, unbelievable, unforgettable. And like I said, he should be still involved in the game. He's very demanding, you know. So at Swindon, when he did leave, there was talk of new owners coming in, and Paolo wanted to bring three new players in. He said, this will guarantee us to get over the line, to get promoted, to get to the next step. The new owners didn't back him. Already the club was sort of living above its means, really. You know, everything Paolo had asked for previously, he got. So the budget and all sorts of stuff were probably very, very high, and club was probably losing money. The new owners who came in weren't prepared to take that risk, take that gamble. And Paolo obviously walked out and ended up at Sunderland. And obviously the Sunderland players, I think, as you know, managed to get him out, I think, in the end, which disappointed for him. But great guy.
Yeah. I mean, just quickly, you said that it's a shame he's not in football. But, I mean, what's the perfect job for Di Canio? Because there seems to be something that takes him over the edge with some players, that he almost becomes, I don't know, a little bit kind of ineffective. But everything he says about the game kind of makes sense, and he obviously knows a lot about the game. So where would his skills lie in the game? Because whether it's not management, is it just as a coach working underneath somebody?
I think he'd have to be a manager. I don't think he would go in as a coach. He's very hands-on as a manager, but he needs to make the decisions. He needs to be the leader. And I don't think he'd go in as someone's coach or someone's assistant manager. He would have to be the manager. Now, it would take a strong chairman to sort of appoint him, someone who'd have to believe in him 100%, because he is all in. And I know we hear of managers working day and night and 24/7. He is 24/7. When he was at Swindon, he is full on. So, yes, it would be a gamble for some chairman to bring him in, but I'm telling you, it would be a gamble paid off if they back him and support him, because he's got so much to offer. off of the game. And you touched on there about when he speaks and you're listening, and it's only when you leave the club. I mean, I believed him at the time when he was telling you all this stuff, and I might looked at him on a couple of occasions and thought, really? You know, we're doing that? Why are we doing this? And it's only when you look back that you think, everything he said, he was right. And lads who's moved on to bigger and better clubs, I look at Aidan Flint, who's obviously at Cardiff now, and he moved on to he went to Sheffield, he's had spells at Sheffield Wednesday, and he's Bristol City, where he ended up after Swindon. And he'll tell you, Paolo was right in stuff he said. Matt Ritchie loved playing under him. He's obviously gone on to bigger and better things at Newcastle. You know, players did enjoy playing from where at the time they might not have been too sure, or they might not have been, oh, Jesus Christ, I love him. I love it. When they've moved on and gone to different clubs, and when Paolo moved, they respect what he did for their careers. I'm telling you.
Yeah. Have you tried taking the tomato sauce away from the Spuddy Mill players yet?
It's funny because when we went to Italy in pre-season, and there's no tomato. Well, I don't like tomato ketchup anyway, so it certainly didn't affect me. But the fitness coach would used to walk around the table, and it's funny because you weren't allowed butter on your toast, but then on an evening there was all this rice cake or whatever, which was full of butter, and you were allowed a piece of that. So a bit bizarre. He was a bit thingy with milk as well in your tea and your coffee, and oh, what are you doing, what you don't, and yeah, some strange things. But it didn't affect me, the tomato ketchup. I wasn't that bothered, and I don't really drink tea or coffee, so I was a bit lucky.
You were sorted. Well, after Swindon, you had spells in Bury and back to Hartlepool. I mean, were you just kind of focused on squeezing as much out of your playing career at the time? Because you took over as caretaker briefly at Swindon after Paolo Di Canio left. So was going down the coaching route, was that always the plan?
It was. I was in the middle of doing my coaching badges when I was at Swindon, actually. I'd started them the year before, and it was something I was always wanting to get into after I'd finished playing. And me and Darren Ward were asked to take the team by the chairman when Paolo walked out. We were obviously the senior professionals at the club. And we said, definitely, no problem whatsoever. We'll look after the team for the next couple of weeks or whatever it may be. But both of us still played. And both of us weren't prepared to come out the team because we still felt fit. We still felt we had something to offer on the field. I think we had three games. And after that, we went to see the chairman and said, listen, this is not for us. We want to focus on playing. We've done what we can, but we've got too much to offer on the field. And I look back and I think, was that an opportunity for me to maybe get into managing and coaching at an early age as such? But then I think the timing certainly wasn't right because I wanted to play and I was still doing my badges. I wasn't ready for it, you know. As much as I think opportunity, no, at the time I wasn't ready for it. And we brought Kevin McDonald came in and Mark Cooper came into the system, and back season petered out. We ended up in the playoffs and got beat by Brentford. And then the next season I moved on and I ended up going to Bury.
Mm. Yeah. And obviously going into coaching, I mean, you joined Spennymoor as assistant manager to Jason Ainsley in 2016, I think it was. So how did you get involved there originally?
Well, I'd left Halifax. We'd won the FA Trophy with Halifax. I'd joined Halifax in October, November of 2015. I was unsure what I was going to do. I'd left Hartlepool. Halifax were part-time in the National League. They were ringing me. They had a bad start of the season. I think I signed in October time, and they were adrift at the bottom even at that early stage. And I had one game, the manager got the sack, Darren Kelly, and Jim Harvey, who was the assistant, took over, and he just said, listen, would you help me out for the next few weeks and see how we get on? So I did. I ended up sort of not playing, helping out Jim Harvey as assistant, and it was a good learning curve for me. You know, I was taking sessions. I was sort of seeing what it was all about. And as much as the results didn't go well for us, you know, it was a very hard season, long season, a struggle. We've got it down to the last game of the season where we needed to win to stay up, and we drew 1-1. I think it was against Macclesfield, and we hit the bar in the 89th, 90th minute, and if that had gone in, we'd have stayed up. And then a few weeks later we were in the FA Trophy final against Grimsby, who had been promoted that season from the National League, and we beat them in the final, which was a great achievement, but it was bittersweet because of relegation 3 weeks earlier. the chairman already had someone lined up to come in into Halifax. So Jim moved on, myself moved on, and Jason Ainsley got in touch pretty much straight away, really, and just said, listen, there's an opportunity. Why don't you come along, come and have a chat? I'd met Jason a few times over the years, and great guy, you know, very good guy. Spoke to me about the ambitions of the club. I went to see the chairman, who just blew us away with the ideas and how the club's run. I mean, it is run better than some professional teams I've been at. It is going in the right direction, and everything the chairman said to me in 2016 has been true. You know, there's been no grey areas. Everything he said, he's done, and we're just looking to progress as a club. And as an assistant manager under Jason, I learned a lot. You know, Jason didn't do any coaching. He let me do all the coaching, which was brilliant, because it was something I wanted to do and loved every minute of it. And now Jason sort of stepped aside and concentrated more on his school job. He's still going to be an ambassador at the club. It's now a chance for me to be the main man as such, and to be the manager, and I'm going to give it me best shot, and hopefully we can push on and have a good season.
Yeah, I was going to say Jason Ainsley, but a bit of a club legend. You know, 14 years, 11 trophies, and it's kind of not often, you know, managers kind of follow someone, you know, like that, who's been that successful. You know, it doesn't happen that often. Obviously, it helped that you worked under him, but I mean, it must have been a big opportunity to continue what he was doing there.
It is. It's a fantastic opportunity to follow on the good work he's done, you know, along with the chairman. Him and the chairman have got this club to where it is now, you know, and the next step is obviously trying to get out of this league. You know, we come close a couple of years ago, we got beaten in the playoff final off Chorley, and we want to be knocking on the door again this year. It's a very tough competitive league, and we are playing against six full-time clubs in the league. You know, we're only part-time, so I'm not saying that's a guarantee if you're full-time you're going to get promoted, but it can help, you know, because you've got lads from Monday to Friday with you, and then on a weekend with the game, whereas we have some lads who work during the day and then they come with us on a night. But we do the best with what we've got, and we've got some good players at this club who could easily play higher, and hopefully, like I say, this season we can push on and be in and around it and look to get out of it, give ourselves the best chance.
Yeah. And I was looking at your pre-season friendlies, and you've got nine, and Sunderland is the second, I think, after Newton Aycliffe. I mean, from your point of view, you know, kind of obviously managing things, are the first few friendlies getting a feel of things again, especially after so long out, and then it's a case of trying to, you know, ramp things up to be kind of at your peak at the start of the season when it comes around?
They are, you know, it's an early one for us. You know, July the 3rd, it's an early one for everyone, really. It's an early pre-season friendly. Yeah, we've got one next week against Newton Aycliffe. It's all about getting minutes for lads, you know. We'll probably give lads 45, 60 minutes. You know, some lads might have to play 90 minutes. But it's a friendly we're looking forward to. It's just a shame that the ground isn't open fully for away fans, because we would have gotten a lot in. So from a revenue point of view, financially, it could have been better. But we understand the rules and the implications and what it is at the minute. But we're looking forward to playing Sunderland. It'll be a good game, you know, a good test, even though it's early. But our chairman, his company, I don't know if you know, is Great Annual Savings, which obviously sponsors Sunderland on the front of the shirt. It's a fantastic company, you know, energy provided, does all the utilities. Great business. So we're looking forward to the friendly. We're looking forward to the game, and looking forward to testing ourselves again. A good opposition and some good players, if Sunderland have enough players to play us.
Yeah, well, that's it. I've read somewhere the Great Annual Savings Derby. There should be some sort of trophy or something at the end of it. Just in terms of, I mean, it is unfortunate, like you say, 1,122, I think, is allowed in the ground, which is unfortunate. But like you say, it's Sunderland's first pre-season game. And actually, I mean, maybe thinking about it, you know, back to your playing days when you had a summer and you kind of got back to playing in the first pre-season friendly against maybe kind of a local non-league side. I mean, what are you expecting from Sunderland? Because it's been a pretty you know, quiet so far on the transfer front as well. And the, like you said, it is early doors. You know, they haven't had much time on the training pitch. So, kind of, what are you expecting from Sunderland? Are they just kind of be kind of getting back into it very slowly?
Yeah, they will be. They won't be full throttle, I don't think. Yes, they'll bring a strong team. I mean, they're probably going to have to bring some of the lads from the under-23s as well, because I know a lot of players have moved on. He'll obviously be trying to get players in, new signings. Whether he'll have any in, I don't know. Ideally, we would have liked to have played them a bit later in pre-season, if I'm honest, and he probably is thinking the same. But we've missed that much football, you know, with COVID, certainly at our level. We're desperate for a game, you know. We're desperate to get some fans in the ground as well, albeit it'll only be the home fans, but they'll enjoy coming, you know. They'll enjoy seeing Sunderland here, and they'll be looking forward to watching them and obviously us. So it'll be a good game, good occasion. We're excited and looking forward.
Yeah, good stuff. Well, I've seen you've got Doncaster as well at some point. So, you know, when the League One fixtures come out, if we've got them early doors, you can maybe do us a favour there. But just quickly on Spennymoor, like you said, you know, when the league was abandoned, you know, there was, you know, everyone had played all different kind of amounts of games. It was all over the shop, but you were only 3 points behind the playoffs and you had games in hand. So, I mean, going into this season, kind of what's, if you've got a target, if you've got an ambition, what are you thinking ahead of this season?
Yeah, I mean, we know where we want to be. We want to keep pushing on from year to year. The last full season we had, we got beaten in the playoff final. The year after that got cut short, and we missed out on the playoffs through points per game, which was disappointing, you know. But it is what it is. And then obviously we've only just played 13 games in the season just gone, and we were sitting mid-table with about 5 games in hand, and if we won them 5 games in hand, we could have been at the top of the league. So it's one of them. We want to be in and around it, definitely. We want to be competing at the top end of the table with the players I've got and with the players I'm hoping to bring in. I'm confident we can be where we want to be, in and around it. We're looking forward to the season. As I keep saying, it's a competitive league and there's some good clubs in it, but we can compete with the best, and that's what we aim to do.
Yeah, and just in terms of yourself, you've obviously got a big project at Spennymoor, but kind of being just two levels below the Football League, is it an obvious ambition of yours to become a manager there, whether it's with Spennymoor, you kind of take them up, or with another team? Is that your kind of long-term ambition?
Of course it is. Yeah, you want to keep progressing on a personal point of view as well. I'd love to be able to do it with Spennymoor, absolutely, because the chairman is a very loyal person, and he's shown loyalty towards certain members of staff at the club over the years. He's been great with me, and I want to repay him for the faith he's put in me. So I'd love to be able to do it with Spennymoor and get them out of this league and get them to the next level, and then one day hopefully get them into the Football League, which is the long-term aim. It's not going to be easy, but that is the objective one day. And if it's with Spennymoor, we're great. Along the years and as time goes on and an opportunity comes from a team in the Football League, then it's something you have to look at. But you take one thing at a time, and like I say, Spennymoor is the main object and the prime sort of team that we want to get up.
And just with Sunderland, you know, back in the days when we could go every week, were you able to get along to the stadium to follow the lads when Spennymoor went play?
I did, you know. I could get in when I could get a ticket. You know, I'm quite fortunate. I ended up going to the playoff game, the home game. Which, I mean, let's be honest, the game should have been over at half time. It should have been 4 or 5 at half time, and second half, you know, they were always going to come out firing. You know, in the second half, and they did. They had chances, and they Sunderland unfortunately just missed out, which was a it's a shame, because it's when I left the club, you know, the team obviously got promoted into the Premier League, and then they're getting into the Championship. And for a team of that size to be in League One is it's sad, really, to watch it from the sort of decline of it. And I just hope Lee Johnson is the man to get them back up into the Championship, and then to kick on to get them into the next level, because a club of that size he's certainly in the wrong division. But then you can say that about a few clubs who've managed to end up down there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, later in your career, you played at that level and you were trying to get up to the Championship with various clubs. I mean, do you think, especially with Sunderland, I mean, like you said, the size that we are, do you think it's a case of the longer we stay at the level, the harder it is to get back up?
It is. Yeah, it is. I mean, yeah, ideally, you want to bounce back straight away and get up the first attempt. And if that doesn't happen, then obviously you go again. But it gets harder the longer you're down there. And obviously finances and stuff like that obviously get cut. I know there's a new chairman come in and I don't know what the situation is with financial fair play and all that and what you can spend and what you can't. I don't know, but I'm sure he'll be supporting Lee Johnson and I'm sure Lee Johnson will get the right players in to have a right good go at it. You know, he's got a full pre-season with them. He'll have his own ideas of who he needs to get in and, you know, there's all sorts of stories. Charlie White, he's out of contract and I know he gets a lot of criticism, Charlie, and he was a young lad who came to Hartlepool when I was there and he's had a fantastic season. You know, anyone who's scored 31 goals, it can't be last that and he's been phenomenal, so he needs replacing. You know, you're going to need someone who would score that amount of goals or near enough. So Lee will have his own ideas, Lee will have his own targets and like I say, I wish him well and hope he can get them. Have a good season and get them out of that league.
Yeah, that's it. I'd almost forgotten about that Lincoln game before you brought it up again, Tommy. cheers for that.
Well, I know, I didn't really want to, but...
yeah, well, never know. Maybe this season we could see a Sunderland Spennymoor promotion double, which would be cracking. But you never know. But on that wonderful thought, I'd just like to say thank you very much, Tommy. Really enjoyed catching up and we really appreciate you taking the time out for us.
No problem whatsoever. Thanks very much for having me on and I'd like to say good luck to Sunderland for the new season and hopefully they can do it this season.
Yeah, good stuff. And hope you enjoy the friendly as well and you have a cracking season.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Good stuff. And thanks again to everyone listening. Keep an eye on the website at Roper Report for new pods and our ramp up for the new season. But from us, it's bye for now.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.